PFAS are synthetic chemicals found in many products, including food packaging, household cleaners, and nonstick cookware. It's an acronym you may have seen or heard of in recent years, as studies on these very common chemicals have revealed their potentially negative health effects for humans and the environment. That's primarily because certain types of PFAS, such as perfluorooctane acid and perfluorooctane sulfonate, don't break down in the environment or in the human body, and that may cause problems. The latest data show that an estimated 200 million Americans are drinking water contaminated with PFAS, a group of comprising thousands of chemicals that have been in commercial products since the 1930s to make surfaces resist stains, water, and grease. Two classes of PFAS, PFOA and PFOS, have been extensively studied and have been linked with numerous adverse health effects. As of 2015, neither PFOA or PFOS chemicals are manufactured or used in the U.S. due to health and environmental concerns, according to the rules of the EPA's stewardship program from the substances, signed in 2006. Both chemicals persist in the environment because they don't degrade. Today, municipalities across the country, including Wisconsin communities, are working to find ways to keep PFAS out of residents' drinking water. But with the continuing lack of a federal regulatory standard, those efforts have been complicated, to say the least. Welcome to Route 51. I'm Rick Ryer, in for Shireen Seward. Today, we'll be talking with two experts to help us understand the concerns about PFAS and the regulatory standards under consideration, and explore ways to keep our own families safe. Throughout the program, we invite you to join the conversation. Ask your own questions by calling 800-780-9742. Again, that phone number is 800-780-9742. Dr. Sarah Yang is a groundwater toxicologist with the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. Her job duties include developing groundwater standards for the protection of public health, conducting human health risk assessments, and developing communication materials related to drinking water hazards. Sarah started at DHS in October of 2017. Before that, she was an environmental toxicologist with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. She holds a doctorate degree in molecular and environmental toxicology from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Dr. Yang, thank you so much for joining us today.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And Steve Elmore is the director of the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources Bureau of Drinking Water and Groundwater, part of the Division of Environmental Management at the agency. He has worked with the DNR for more than 20 years, spending several years as a water supply specialist and engineer, as well as the public water supply section chief. He studied geological engineering at Purdue University and has extensive experience in hydrology and water resources science. Steve, welcome to Route 51.
Good morning. Glad to be here, Rick.
Dr. Yang, I'd like to start with you. How deadly are PFAS, and are they all dangerous?
Yeah, that is a great question. So as you mentioned earlier, PFAS is a class of compounds. So far, we know that there's more than 5,000 different types of PFAS. And what we do know is that there's definitely differences in the health risk between the different types of PFAS. So as you mentioned before, PFOA and PFOS are the most well-studied PFAS. Those are definitely the ones that we know the most about their health effects. Now, in general, when we're looking at environmental contaminants that people can get exposed to in their drinking water, we may find levels that cause health problems. That isn't necessarily things like death. So far, what we know from studies in communities where there have been high levels of PFOA or PFOS in their drinking water is that PFAS can cause a number of different health effects, including increased cholesterol levels, decreased response to certain vaccines, effects on fertility, and some other health effects. So these are hazardous to our health, but I guess I wouldn't say that they're deadly to us.
Okay, well, thank you for that. And Steve, specifically, where are PFAS found and typically, and how do they get into the drinking water in the first place?
Okay, yeah, we have found PFAS in drinking water in Wisconsin, both in private wells and in public water systems, such as the city of Wausau has found some PFAS in the municipal water supply. So they get there through a variety of means. Generally, if PFAS is used and somehow discharged to the surface of the ground, it can move through groundwater just by the natural percolation of rain through the soil. It can move that PFAS into the groundwater, and then it can move towards our wells that we use for drinking. So some of the activities that could get PFAS into our drinking water may be using firefighting foam when a fire is put out on the surface of the ground. Some of the leftover foam may be on the soil and move into groundwater and towards our wells. It does, one of the properties of PFAS is that it moves very readily in groundwater. It stays in the in solution in the water as it moves through groundwater. It doesn't get sort of filtered out by natural means.
Well, Steve, is it just water that we should be concerned about?
No, there's other ways you can be exposed to PFAS. As we've talked about here a little bit already, it is found on nonstick cookware. That can be an exposure if you use those types of products that have a coating that includes PFAS in it. Some clothing and some household products like carpeting or the fabrics on your couch, your upholstery may contain PFAS, and you may be exposed to PFAS in that way. But drinking water is one of the main ways we may be exposed to PFAS if it is in your drinking water.
And Sarah, in the conversation about PFAS, we've always been hearing the term forever chemicals. What does that mean, and why are they called forever chemicals?
Yeah, so that is for two different reasons. You know, as you and Steve mentioned, they can stay in the environment a long time. So there isn't anything natural that can break down these bonds in PFAS, which makes them really, you know, persistent and contributes to the fact that, you know, they can continue to move through groundwater and be found there a lot. Along the same lines, they also stay in our bodies a long period of time. So depending on the length of the chain on PFAS, so PFOA and PFOS have an 8-carbon chain. The longer the chain of the PFAS, the longer it will stay in our body. It can bind to the proteins in our blood and just kind of hangs out there and stays there for a long time. So for PFOA and PFOS, we're talking about a half-life of around 8 years. Half-life means the amount of time that it takes the chemical to decrease in your body by half. So that's not even, you know, the full length of time it would stay in our bodies.
So it can decrease in our bodies. It's there, but it eventually goes away?
Yes. So our body can eliminate it. It's just really slowly. And if we continue to be exposed to it, we're kind of, you know, slowly building up the level in our body because it builds up faster. It can build up faster than we can get rid of it.
Okay. Steve, when did the DNR first identify PFAS in the state's water supply? And is this a new phenomenon or has it been around for a long time?
Well, PFAS has been used in products since, I think, around the 1940s, for quite some time. We first started learning about PFAS in I guess, the early 2000s. We became aware of PFAS in our neighboring state, Minnesota. You may be familiar with near the Twin Cities, there's quite a large PFAS contamination plume there in groundwater that was caused by the manufacture and use of PFAS by the 3M company near the Twin Cities there. So that's when we first started learning about PFAS. And then in drinking water in Wisconsin and nationally, we started testing for PFAS in some water supplies. Starting in 2013, there was some required testing by the United States Environmental Protection Agency, what we call unregulated contaminant monitoring. And they monitored several public water systems in Wisconsin. And through that testing, we did find it in La Crosse, Rhinelander and West Bend, Wisconsin. And those systems, we've been in contact with them since then. The one thing to note is since that testing in 2013 that lasted till about 2016, since then, we have better laboratory methods for analyzing for PFAS. And so some of the more recent detections we found is because those lab methods are more sensitive and can detect lower levels of PFAS. And so that's part of why we're just now seeing PFAS in, for instance, the city of Wausau.
Okay. Brings up this next question, Sarah. Why is it now that we're hearing more about PFAS rather than a few years ago, 2013,
yeah,
2006?
Great question. So as Steve alluded to, our analytical technologies have gotten a lot better. So we can actually detect PFAS at a lot lower levels than we were able to even, 5-10 years ago. And what we're learning is that the health effects that we're concerned about are occurring at these really low levels. So historically, we've seen samples coming back as no detect, where they may have had, pretty low levels of PFAS in it. And the information that we're getting now from more recent scientific studies is that those low levels can cause health issues. So that's where that new health concern is coming in, is that we're learning more about what kinds of health effects PFAS can cause, at what levels they can cause them. We're learning a lot more about how long PFAS stays in the body and what that can do in terms of, making sure we're protecting from them.
Well, similarly, why does the FDA itself allow PFAS to be applied to food contact surfaces like what Steve was talking about earlier, nonstick pans?
Yeah, so all the federal agencies are learning about the health effects of PFAS. So at this point in time, if PFAS are being used on a food surface, they are not those long chain PFAS, the PFOA and PFOS, that we know cause health effects. We're still learning about the other PFAS. As I mentioned, there's 5,000 different PFAS. There's not data on every single PFAS, to know health risk, but they evaluate, health of the ones that they know are in use.
Okay. So what level of PFAS exposure can cause these adverse health effects in humans? And why is the DHS recommending a 20 parts per trillion standard versus what was recently recommended by the DNR, if I have that correctly, 70 parts per trillion?
Yeah. So, PFAS is a class of compounds. We actually recommended groundwater standards for 18 different PFAS. Those recommendations include individual standards for 12 PFAS. So those ones have a separate number based on the data we found for those. And then we also are recommending 20 parts per trillion for a group of chemicals for PFOA, PFOS, and then things that can turn into those chemicals in the environment or the body. So for the 20 parts per trillion, we base that on some studies that have come out since EPA's health advisory was issued in 2016. So as I mentioned, we're still learning lots and lots about how PFAS can affect the body. And since 2016, there have been hundreds of studies among people and then research animals specifically looking at the health effects of PFOA and PFOS. What we know now is that these chemicals can affect the immune system, and they may do that at really low levels, so levels below EPA's health advisory. We also know that unborn babies and breastfed babies are really sensitive to the exposure of PFAS. So PFAS, they can get exposure even while they're being developed in the womb. And so our 20 parts per trillion health advisory and recommendation is based on making sure we're protecting that baby from exposure. Because again, it's building up in our body. So the sooner we can reduce our exposure in our bodies, the more protective we're going to be in the long run.
Okay. And Steve, what is the DNR's perspective on DHS's recommendation of 20 parts per trillion?
That is the recommendation that we are going with, so to speak. I mean, that's the best health advice that that we have is the recommendation from DHS. It's what we're using when we're working with communities to recommend reducing exposure to PFAS in drinking water. The 70 parts per trillion that was passed by our Natural Resources Board, that was done because the 70 parts per trillion is the current U.S. EPA health advisory level for PFOA and PFOS. We know, though, that information is outdated at this time. Dr. Sarah Yang just provided as a response, that's the most recent information. And we do expect a new toxicity assessment and draft maximum contaminant level for drinking water from EPA this year that will give us even more information and their, you know, US EPA's perspective on what the health-based level should be for drinking water for these two compounds, PFOA and PFOS.
Okay. You're listening to Steve Elmore and Dr. Sarah Yang on Route 51 as we discuss the emerging science of PFAS and the way they're regulated. Coming up, we'll hear more about the standards the EPA is preparing to set for PFAS in drinking water, and we'll answer your questions as well. You can call us at 800-780-9742. Again, that's 800-780-9742. I'm Rick Ryer. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. Steve Elmore and Sarah Yang are our guests today as we take an in-depth look at PFAS. And you're encouraged to join the conversation by calling 800-780-9742. Sarah, let's, you know, you mentioned earlier about some of the health effects that you're concerned about and that we all are and should be concerned about with related to with PFAS. But can you talk a little bit more specifically about the health effects that we know are associated with this issue? What are the biggest risks?
Sure. So a lot of what we know about PFAS comes from studies among people who were exposed to high levels either through their jobs, so maybe people who worked in a factory where they made PFAS chemicals, or in communities that had really high levels of exposure. And, you know, there have been a number of studies looking at a variety of health effects in those people. And of all of that information, the health effects that have the strongest evidence is effects on cholesterol levels, effects on antibody response to certain vaccines. So how many antibodies does our body make after we're given a vaccine for something? And then decreased fertility in women. Now, those aren't all the effects, you know, that we've seen in these studies, but those are the ones that have the strongest evidence and for, you know, for multiple PFAS, not just PFOA or PFOS specifically. Okay. We also look at studies among research animals to, you know, try to figure out at what level those health effects occur. And so in research animals, one of those key effects that we're seeing there is effects on development. So, development of, you know, either unborn babies or babies after they're born. And that's part of, you know, why we're setting the standard at the level we are to make sure we're protecting for that so we don't see that in people.
Okay, understood. Steve, how difficult is it for municipalities to remove PFAS from drinking water in the treatment systems? What kinds of remediation efforts are actually working?
Yeah, so there's a couple of different technologies that are existing to remove PFAS from drinking water. And the first is what we call granulated activated carbon. It's a filter that includes a type of carbon in it that the water passes through, and the PFAS basically attaches to that carbon, and then it doesn't stay in the water. The water can pass through clean then. The other technology is called anion exchange, where a certain resin type material is in a filter, and the water passes through that, and the PFAS particles attach to that resin in there and is removed from the drinking water. Both of these types of technology, you do have to then remove that material, either the carbon or the resin, when too much PFAS has attached to it, and replace it with new fresh material there to keep that filter removing the PFAS as you expect it to. So okay. Those are the two main technologies, and I'm talking about technologies that we use on the municipal scale. So like what the city will install in their well house to remove PFAS from the drinking water. There is also, filters you can buy as a homeowner that you can either install in your home to remove PFAS. They use similar technology, particularly the granulated activated carbon technology can be found in filters that are certified to remove PFAS. And so if you're looking for something like that, you should look for something that says NSF Standard 53 certified, and it should specifically say it's certified to reduce PFAS in drinking water. So that's something important to look for. Not just any filter will remove PFAS. Those are a couple ways. To wrap up, I'll mention that water utilities can also look to drill a new well in an area that's not contaminated with PFAS. They can also blend together water that they know is lower in PFAS or doesn't have any PFAS with a well that maybe has shown to have PFAS in it. So those are ways they can reduce the levels coming into people's homes, into the taps in people's homes.
Okay, now you mentioned these PFAS will attach themselves to the carbon or to the resin, and then those filters, if you will, need to be replaced, correct?
Yes.
How are the old filters disposed of safely so that doesn't leak back into the groundwater?
That's a great question. There are places that will take that waste that has PFAS in it, but that is a big question when we put in a filtration system. Is we have to answer that question: how are we going to dispose of that waste? Where are we taking that when the filter is used up, so to speak?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's something that we work through as part of our approval of a filtration system.
And then the average, the homeowner that has something on their faucet and that the little filter needs to be changed, do they just put it in the garbage?
That's a good question. Sarah, I don't know if you have a take on, the disposal, the household disposal of those filters.
Yeah, that is a great question. I guess I don't know for sure. I think, I wouldn't be surprised if they end up in the garbage can. I think there are certain companies that do try to regenerate the carbon filters. So I don't know if that's something that happens on the homeowner scale of the treatment systems, but it would be something worth, looking into if a person is interested in buying one of those, is if there's somewhere, on the packaging or something that the company says, like, that they will take those cartridges back so that they can kind of refurbish them, basically.
That would really be good to know, because when you buy a package in there, that the print is real small, it's kind of hard to read in the first place. But not knowing what to do with the filter once it's used up, I mean, that's a big deal, because you're taking the carbon out and it's attaching itself to, or the PFAS out and attaching itself to the carbon. But then what? We've got to put a new filter in, and we're not told what to do with that filter, except you think just put it in the garbage and it goes out with every week or like normal, but that's not necessarily the right thing to do, maybe.
Yeah, and sorry, we don't have a great answer for that.
I
know that when the municipality might remove the carbon from their filtration system at the treatment plant, there are places that will take that. It is hard to destroy PFAS. And so there are some methods, though, at very high heat, you can incinerate that carbon and PFAS and destroy it, but it needs to be a specific facility that is designed to do that. And I know that there's a lot of challenges with that already. That's another area of sort of emerging technology and science regarding PFAS. It's the ultimate destruction.
Okay. That's great. I appreciate your honesty on that. In Eau Claire and Rothschild and some other communities, officials have shut down some affected water wells after discovering PFAS in the system and combined water from other wells to keep the levels lower. But in Wausau, all the wells have been contaminated. When all wells are contaminated and blending isn't possible, what happens? What's the recommendation?
Yeah, so the city of Wausau now, they do have PFAS in all their active wells there. And we're working closely with them on a solution. They have submitted a what we call a pilot study, it's some engineering details on what some different filters will look like that will we expect will remove PFAS, but we're looking for the best setup there. So they have sort of three different scenarios that they're going to be testing there and running water through those three different treatments for some time. And they will test the water coming out of those treatments and determine which is removing PFAS the best and works best for their water quality that they're dealing with there. And then once they've selected, you know, one of those from the pilot, then they'll build out a full a treatment plant that's based on whichever technology they've selected. And so they're looking at both ion exchange and granulated activated carbon as some of those options.
How challenging will that be to incorporate that new piece into the design moving forward, specific to the Wausau plant?
You know, Wausau is actually in a unique position right now. You may be familiar that they're in the process of building a whole new treatment plant overall to treat the drinking water in Wausau coming from all the wells. And they do have room in that treatment plant, so to speak, to add this additional treatment to remove PFAS. So, you know, not all treatments the same. The treatment that they're looking at is for more, you know, that they've been building is for more common contaminants like organic material and things that are acidic, things that not that they're going to affect your health, but affect the look and the taste of the water. And but in that treatment plant, they have enough space where they can add this treatment for PFAS. And so that they're fortunate in that regard, and it should be a fairly smooth transition, we hope, to add that treatment.
Okay. Sarah, we did talk a little bit about before the EPA and what they're looking at, potentially planning on a 20 part per trillion regulatory standard. Is that the level you think we'll see? Could they go lower? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so our proposal, you know, our recommendation is a 20 parts per trillion. That's Wisconsin-specific health advisory. You know, EPA submitted some draft resources to their science advisory board earlier this year to start the process. When they submitted that, they did indicate that they were anticipating any health advisory or drinking water standard that came out of that process would be significantly lower than their 70 parts per trillion health advisory from 2016. But at this point in time, we don't know, you know, what that number will be, other than it will likely be lower than 70.
Okay. So in the meantime, where we're still kind of in between trying to figure out what we're doing with the parts per trillion, looking at your recommendation of, I should say DHS recommendation of 20 parts per trillion, is water in the Wausau area safe right now? Does it present a health risk?
Yeah. So, you know, in any case where we have water that has the PFOA and PFOS levels above 20 parts per trillion, DHS considers that to pose a health hazard.
Okay.
You know, this does not mean, you know, people need to immediately panic, but it's where we want people to take action, right? We want people to be aware of the situation and take action to protect their health.
Okay. So, you know, in February, WASA Mayor Katie Rosenberg was criticized by the NRB member Fred Prine, who accused her of causing hysteria by alerting the public to PFAS in the city's drinking water. Steve, what is your reaction to that?
Well, I don't think anyone's trying to create hysteria here. I mean, what we know is that these compounds have been found in drinking water, in the drinking water in Wausau. And just like Dr. Sarah Yang just mentioned, we're asking people to reduce their exposure at this time to that drinking water in order to protect their health. It's similar to other health recommendations that that people might be familiar with. Your doctor might give you a recommendation to limit your alcohol intake. These things are all different, so I hesitate to compare them. But there's other types of health recommendations we might get, and this is just one more that we need to keep track of, and that's right now to limit your intake of drinking water because it has PFAS in it. I don't know if you want to add to that, Sarah.
Go ahead, Sarah, please.
Right. Yeah, you know, I guess the piece I would add is, you know, we really tried to build into the process and the communication, you know, what people can do to take action, right? So from that, you know, we know that PFAS at higher levels can cause a health risk, but we also know that when we reduce our PFAS exposure, either by drinking alternate water or, you know, getting rid of those scratched up Teflon pans, we can reduce our exposure and, you know, the levels in our body will come down. So all of those things kind of get built together to overall decrease the levels of PFAS in our body.
Okay. Steve Elmore and Dr. Sarah Yang, our guests today on Route 51, as we take an in-depth look at PFAS, the forever chemicals that are making headlines across the state as more municipalities discover high levels in residential drinking water. We'd like to hear from you. Join us at 800-780-9742. Again, that phone number to join the conversation, ask your question about PFAS, is 800-780-9742. I'm Rick Ryer. You're listening to Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Rick Ryer. Our guests today are Steve Elmore and Sarah Yang as we continue our discussion on PFAS and their potential for harm. What would you like to know? Join us at 800-780-9742. Related to our last couple of parts of the conversation, does the DNR prompt municipalities to warn the public? What's their role in that? What's your role, Steve?
Yeah, good question. So when we become aware that there's a contaminant in drinking water that may affect public health, we do have the authority and to require what we call a public notice, that information about that contaminant and the health effects that are caused by that contaminant needs to be communicated to the customers of that water system, that public water system. And so so we have that authority, and we follow through by working closely with the utility and helping them craft that public notice and get that information out to the public. We've also been working with all the utilities with media availability sessions so that we can effectively help get that message out as efficiently as possible.
Simple question, maybe. Can you taste PFAS in the drinking water?
No.
No, there's no taste to PFAS. So it's colorless and odorless.
Okay. We did talk briefly about the home systems, home remediation with the sink filters and whole house filters. But the another option is bottled water. What we understand is not all bottled water is created equal. Sarah, what should people be looking for to find bottled water that does not contain PFAS? And when we know that, some do.
Yeah, so when we're looking at bottled water, we really want to look at bottled water that says it's been filtered or purified. So that's water that we know has been treated in some way that could that would remove any PFAS that was there. The FDA does have health thresholds for, or I guess they're like just thresholds for how much PFAS that they would like to see in bottled water. I don't think they're regulations at this point, but my understanding is that most bottled water organizations are following those recommendations. There's also a International Association for Bottled Water Manufacturers, and they have their own guidelines. You know, they want to make sure they're producing water that's safe for consumers. So again, look for that purified or filtered label on the bottled water.
Okay. Is it safe to eat fish in our local lakes and rivers with this going on? How do we know?
So we would want to follow the fish consumption advisories, which are available. You know, the latest advisories are available on DNR's webpage. They have a great map and a handbook. Those, you know, will help. By following those, will help reduce any PFAS exposure from fish.
We talked a lot about, you know, over the past number of minutes about the health effects of the potential health effects of PFAS in our drinking systems. Should people get their blood tested?
So people can get their blood tested. The challenge is that there's no level of PFAS in the blood that we can say, oh, if your level is below X, you're safe. So right now what we know is that people who lived in communities where they had very high levels of PFAS exposure, or people who worked in a plant that had made PFAS, have really high levels of PFAS in their blood. The average everyday American citizen has some PFAS in their blood. So doing a test for blood could tell you where you fall in that range, but it's not going to necessarily tell you are you at a greater risk, you know, for those health effects we talked about. It's just going to tell you where you kind of fall in relation to the national average.
Talking more about filtration systems, I know, Steve, we talked about the carbon systems that people can put in their homes. What about the simplest of all those, the pitchers that you can purchase? Are they as effective?
Yeah, I mean, something, if it's listed as NSF Standard 53 certified, and it says it's designed to remove PFAS, then you can trust that it does that. And I believe there are some pitcher filters out there on the market that are NSF Standard 53 approved or certified. So that's what you need to look for. You need to follow the recommendations on that product to replace that filter at the right interval. If it says replace the filter every month or something, that's what you need to follow. So that's I guess the basic recommendation there.
Okay, Sarah, you mentioned earlier about other parts points of exposure like fabric and clothing and in upholstery, cookware, and that kind of thing. And the assumption is that the exposure would be absorbed through their skin. Am I correct in that assumption?
So no, that's not correct. Well,
okay.
So most PFAS do not actually travel through our skin.
Okay.
So when we're talking about cookware, you know, we're talking about, you know, scraping off and accidentally swallowing some of that material. When we're talking about the textiles, we're actually talking about that dust that can be formed, you know, like micro dust in our house from our carpet and from our furniture. And we're actually like breathing in that dust. So from that standpoint, we actually recommend that people vacuum regularly just to kind of, you know, make sure we're keeping that dust level down. But the biggest thing about bathing and swimming is just making sure that we're not accidentally swallowing that water, particularly young children, you know, because I look around and there's my son in the bathtub, you know, with his face under the water. So like making sure that our kids are, you know, also taking those safe steps and not accidentally swallowing the water.
Okay. Who ultimately is going to be footing the bill for PFAS contamination cleanup? Is that us as a society, you know, kind of big picture thing? Or if you look at it from the municipality standpoint, who foots the bill for all of this? Steve, I'll go to you.
Yeah, it's fairly complicated, that answer, because it really depends on, you know, how the PFAS got out into the environment. Was there a industry that caused that? Was it from firefighting foam used for, you know, public safety measures, you know, fighting fires? You know, we have a process where we look at who is the responsible party, you know, who is responsible for this contamination. And then we have a program, Remediation Redevelopment here at the DNR, that works with those responsible parties to do an investigation and cleanup of those activities. With PFAS, it gets pretty complicated, though, because you have some of those responsible parties, you know, in some instances, I'll point out, the city of Madison is one example of this, where they have contamination in their one of the wells that it looks like it's coming from the airport and the Truax Field here in Madison, and although that's still being investigated, and the county and city have been owners of that site, or, you know, part owners of that site that caused the contamination. They're also the ones that have a well that was contaminated. So they're both a receiver of that contamination and a person that in part has caused that contamination. So these things are getting complicated with PFAS, and we're trying to work together with all those involved to address what's the best way to investigate where's the contamination coming from, and how do we remediate it? How do we clean it up? That's more of the long term, you know, on these things. Really what we're focused on in the short term is, you know, well, real short term, how do we reduce exposure? How do we get people to drink bottled water? The next step is how do we, treat the drinking water so that people can just drink water out of their tap again. And then the third bit is, how do we remediate that? How do we ultimately clean up and try to restore the environment as much as we can? And so all of those, you know, phases have a cost to them. And we're working through how that all gets, you know, paid for right now.
Well, you know, speaking of remediation and fixing the issues, one of the things that has come up again most recently is that there has not been, or we don't know when, if there will be either, standards developed for rural wells, well owners, versus being on a municipal water system. In these rural areas, how are rural residents finding ways to mitigate the risk, and what programs are available for private well owners?
So the first thing I would say, and I'll let Sarah weigh in here too, but you can get your well tested. If you have a private well that serves your home, you can get it tested for PFAS. There are certified laboratories in Wisconsin and in neighboring states that can analyze that water and tell you how much PFAS is in it, and you can compare those results to the recommended standards from Department of Health Services to see if that water would be safe to drink.
Sarah, do you have anything?
Yeah, so I think, along those lines, I think, you know, there's some areas where we think the risk for there being PFAS in a private well might be higher than others. So it's always, you know, folks can always reach out to us or DNR to kind of talk through that. Like, should I, you know, PFAS testing is pretty expensive, right? So do we, you know, think that would be value added, and we are happy to kind of walk through that and help people with that. Along the lines about resources available and stuff, you know, the standards aren't going to limit the ability for us to help people evaluate their health risk. And, you know, DNR still has processes for groundwater investigations and site remediation. That's, you know, that happens no matter if there is a standard for those contaminants or not. And so we just continue to work through those processes.
Sarah, how is the science emerging in this situation with this issue, and how do you anticipate we'll learn more about the potential impacts moving forward?
Yeah, so, you know, what's kind of interesting about PFAS is that we're learning that lower and lower levels can affect our health. You know, that's not always the case with a contaminant. A lot of times, you know, as we get more data, we get more confident, and then maybe, you know, our numbers can go up because we have less uncertainty in the data. Right now, what we're seeing is that there's, you know, subtle health effects that can occur at these low levels. And we're kind of learning more and more about those subtle health effects. You know, for example, the effects on the immune system are really kind of the forefront of the science. That's actually what EPA's draft recommendations are based on. As we're talking about, you know, PFAS as a class, you know, we'll learn more about those other, you know, 4,998 PFAS. I think we're learning more about how long these different PFAS can stay in our body. So one thing we do know is that the longer it stays in the body, the lower the health threshold is, because we, again, want to reduce that buildup over time. Whereas things that don't seem to stay in the body longer, it's okay if we are exposed to a little bit more, because it's going to pass through our body and be out, you know, in a matter of days or so.
Okay. What about PFAS in animals like pets at home and livestock? Do they also face similar health implications like humans?
Yeah. So one of the things that we've seen, and which is really interesting, is that PFAS seems to act differently in human bodies than it does in specifically research animals. So what we're seeing in these research animal studies is that PFAS can stay a couple days in, you know, a rat, a couple days in a mouse, but years in a human, you know. So we're still learning about the health effects in terms of livestock and cats and dogs and stuff. But you know, the evidence we have so far, you know, is indicating that they are likely at a lesser risk than humans are for this buildup over time and the types of health effects we're talking about.
Okay. What's the end game? You know, how do we take care of this overall? Is it possible within the next 5-10 years to this not being an issue?
Well, I think what we'll see over time is that we will start to get a handle on, you know, for instance, where PFAS is in our drinking water, and you know, through filtration, for instance, we'll you know, break down that exposure to it. The negative effects of that exposure will be reduced, and the thing that's going to be challenging, though, is that, you know, PFAS right now we don't have a way to really destroy it. So it's sort of cycling through our environment, and what we need to do is break down those what we call receptors. How we, you know, like drinking water, like, you know, nonstick pans that may have a PFAS coating. If we eliminate those from our environment and our homes, then we're breaking down our exposure, and we're limiting how the PFAS cycles through the environment, right? Because if we ingest it, you know, it may eventually then be excreted and get in our wastewater, and then it's in our waterways again, right? So if we break down some of these pathways for exposure to PFAS, then we'll be, you know, on a path to, you know, addressing the issues. But ultimately, we need to stop using it entirely, you know, and we need to find ways to destroy PFAS.
Thank you so much. And where can people go to find out more information about filtration systems or other ways to protect their families? Sarah?
Yeah, so we have a brochure on our webpage that describes the different types of in-home treatment systems that people can get for removing PFAS.
All right. Thank you both so much for being here today. We would like to thank Dr. Sarah Yang and Steve Elmore for today's program on Route 51. Thanks to our producer, Joy Ratchkramer, who is also our on-air producer today. If you have an idea for a future program, email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'd love to hear from you. Next week, we'll be back with another fascinating conversation and hope you'll join us. Until then, we're headed out of town.